Welcome to Know Your True Self, a show dedicated to raising the consciousness of humanity. Today, I welcome Estella Rosmus, who is a professor of writing at New York University and host of the Freelance Writing Direct podcast and former All About the Pitch columnist for Writer's Digest. During the course of her illustrious career, she has written on a variety of subjects, including health, beauty, fitness, publishing, business, and travel for numerous well-known publications. Her articles for the New York Times and Washington Post have gone globally viral, with more than 500 comments on her New York Times piece, How to Bully-Proof Your Child. She has also appeared on Good Morning America and has had her articles discussed on The View. Today, I welcome Estella to discuss her new book, Writing That Gets Noticed. Find your voice, become a better storyteller, get published. Let's get started. Hey, Estelle, welcome to Know Your True Self. I am absolutely thrilled to have you as a guest today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
There's a quote that I pulled out of the book, and I can't remember what chapter it's in, but it's from Maya Angelou. And it says, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of you. And it's so true. We all have so many things that go on inside of our life experience, and 80% of people out there want to write a book. 3% of people actually do, but you don't need to write a 60,000-word manuscript to get your story out there. It could be written in 500 words, maybe less, maybe more. The whole idea is we all have something to share. So before we get into some of the awesome content that's inside of your book, help us understand your story and the agony that was inside of you that led to the creation of Writing That Gets Noticed.
Sure. Well, I've kind of lived many lives. I was a magazine editor-in-chief in the 90s and early aughts, and I had a flourishing career. But then I decided to get married in midlife and have a daughter in my mid-40s, and it was a big transition. I was dealing with infertility, and publishers at the time, it was after 9/11, they started pulling in and not giving as much launch money out. So there weren't many publications being launched at the same time publications were closing. So I did a pivot to medical education, which was much drier than the glamorous world of glossy magazines, but it was steady work, it was lucrative, and I was able to leave by 5 p.m. to go home, whereas before I was staying till 9 at night, going to an event, going home, going to sleep, coming back in the morning and starting all over again, and it just wasn't possible. But after I had my daughter, I decided to be with her at home. And then I had to transition my career yet again. And I had been teaching back when I was a magazine editor-in-chief, I had been teaching at NYU about writing health and beauty for magazines. But that was in the early aughts. And so in all my transitions, I had stopped teaching. When I decided to get back into the publishing world, it happened, and I talk about it a lot in the book. After I had my daughter, I was still doing journalistic work. I had a column for Patch, which then it was by the AOL people. And so it got me back into journalism. But I hadn't written personal essays. I hadn't written anything that was about me. And I felt that my creative energy was dried up because the early work of motherhood takes so much energy. And then couple that with doing it, you know, later than most of your peers are doing it and being a mother and learning everything about it. And I didn't feel it was intuitive. Oh, I'm just going to be the greatest mother ever. I really felt I had to learn what to do. And I had no idea. I had no friends in my realm because their kids were older. They weren't interested in spending time with a little baby. And so I really had to reinvent myself yet again by finding new mom friends, by finding new things to do. I've always had a lot of energy. That has never changed. The creative energy, sometimes it transmutes into other places. So it transmuted into being an advocate for mothers and getting involved with the now defunct organization, Mothers and More. But it wasn't writing. I was not writing my stories. I was just doing little journalistic things that kept me with a finger in a new pie, which was parenting. But then when my daughter was about 18 months old, I went to an event at the library. It was a reading group. And they said that they wanted everyone to sit in the circle and the kids sit next to their parents. And I was sitting, and again, I didn't know anyone. My daughter didn't know anyone. She got up out of where she was supposed to be seated, and she moved into the center of the circle and she began to dance. And I was so worried. I thought, are they going to be mad at her? Are they going to be mad at me? And instead, they just looked at her and smiled and acknowledged this little, you know, toddler's need to be center stage. And I thought, can I ever be like that again? I was once center stage in my publishing career. Could I ever get back there, back in the limelight, you know, ready for the whole world ahead of me? And I wrote an essay and I called it And She Danced. And as I think I'm sure you believe in life, there's a lot of synchronicity, because once you start putting your energy towards something, doors start to open. And so one of the moms in this group said, oh, I heard of a reading series. It's called Listen to Your Mother. And it's moms talking about their stories, reading on stage, sort of like The Moth, which is a storytelling forum. They read their stories on stage that they've written about motherhood.
Wow.
And they're having auditions. And I thought, oh my gosh, well, I just wrote something. And, you know, I know, James, you talk a lot about believing in your internal, your own feeling about yourself and knowing who you are. Well, as a writer, I didn't know yet where I was going to go with my new writing, but I was in a writing group. And I don't think I didn't write about this in the book, but I want to tell you the story because it's really important. In this writing group, there were a lot of technical writers. And when I read my essay to them, they ripped it apart. Okay. They said, oh my God, it doesn't follow in a logical place. You start with this and then you go back to when she was born and then you talk about what she did. And to the credit, not necessarily of me, but of life experience, by the time you've gotten to your 40s, you know a little bit something about life, I think. And so I knew that what I had written was valid and I wasn't going to allow other people's realities to define mine. And that's been a big thread in my whole life, from having a daughter in midlife to getting married later, when the latest survey had said, oh, a woman in their 40s has less chance of getting married than being shot by a terrorist. You know, I mean, and grim. And I just said, I'm not going to let these people define me. And so, you know, and there was one other person in class, she's still a friend, and she said, oh, I love it. I think it's great. And so I submitted it. I auditioned, I went, and I was so nervous because my old life, I'd been in medical education for 7 years and then had my daughter and then another 3 years of just doing, you know, a column for Patch. And I didn't want to say I was a magazine editor in chief, that I had these kind of glory days when I was on TV regularly. And so they said, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a communications professional. And I read my piece, and then I forgot about it, right? Went on with my weekend. Well, the director had been trying to call me all through the weekend, so because apparently everyone was so like, oh my God, did I make it? Did I get in? And I was just like, okay, next. And she said, you got in, you know, you got in. You're in the inaugural performance of Listen to Your Mother in New York City. And that was back in 2012, and it changed my life forever.
That's incredible. And, you know, you bring up a beautiful story there of reinvention, soul searching. And most importantly, I think one of the greatest barriers that comes up with writing is determining what to write. Like, how do I write something that's true and authentic to my human experience, but also that's relevant to culture and has a place? Because chances are, if you have a story to tell, you also want to connect with an audience. So in terms of us as writers coming up with ideas, how do we find that authenticity? How do we find that cultural relevance when we can make the type of impact that you have within your story?
That's a great question, James. And I think because I've been somebody on both sides of the publishing wall, which is what I distill into my book, Writing to Get Noticed, I've been an assigning editor, an editor-in-chief, somebody who is looking and assessing at what's sent to me, as well as somebody who sends out material to editors to be approved, to be accepted, as well as somebody who teaches people how to do that. Very successfully. My students have been published very widely in top publications like In Style, The New York Times, The Washington Post, LA Magazine, just a lot of places. And so I feel that to get ideas, you have to kind of look at what's happening, and I call it in the zeitgeist. You want to see what's going on. And in my book, I set up a mapping template that is very easy to set up that really takes who you are as a person, all the things that make you. Are you an adoptive parent? Did you have a deadbeat dad? Do you love to bowl? Did you study opera? You know, what is it that makes you, and then connect it with what's going on in society at large, because that editors are always looking for relevance in a story. They're looking for a connection. And so if somebody was impactful in your life, who is maybe a celebrity that is not often in the news, I recommend setting up Google alerts about what is going on that's fresh and new with that celebrity. And today with streaming, where, you know, a show like Suits that closed 4 years ago is more relevant than ever, that can really happen. And it happened for me. I wrote a piece about Penny Marshall, who was Laverne, who was the great director of Big, of A League of Their Own. And she had passed away in 2018. I wrote an essay. But the news cycle moves fast. And so I wasn't able to sell it because they'd already had that coverage when she died. But I set up, like I tell my students to do, and like I say in the book, Google alerts on her name. And lo and behold, in 2022, I learned that A League of Their Own was coming back to Amazon Prime as a limited series. I took that, I framed my pitch with the essay that I had, and I sent it to an editor at AARP, The Ethel. And I said, I have a piece about Laverne's impact on my life, how she became my role model. And it's also timely because the show, the movie that she had done is now a limited TV series that's going to be starting this summer. I was early. It wasn't already happening. It was about to happen. And so I got that acceptance. You know, so part of it is never give up. The other thing is connect what's going on in your life to things in the news or future things. I tell people to look at the latest research because sometimes studies will come out. If you are interested in covering the psychology of something, you can go to the American Psychological Association and sign up for their newsletters, which is going to show the latest study. So maybe you're somebody who is obsessed with Pinterest. I'm just making this up. Right. And a study comes out saying people who, you know, who are obsessed with Pinterest make great lovers, according to, I mean, then you have something that you can peg an essay around and you can use it to frame it around something that's new and that's relevant. And that was just a very, you know, basic example, but you can do that with almost everything. You can also keep an eye of what the conversations are. What do you hear? What are the trending topics on X? I call it X. It's X now, but Twitter, for those who don't know, it's X. And any of the other social media, because you could then also do searches for the trending topics, or you could find some way to connect it to your experience. So that is one of my secret tricks for connecting essays and making them like reported essays in a way, but they don't have to be. They just could be connected. It doesn't even have to be reported with the statistics or polls or anything like that. My story wasn't.
Right. I love that because there's definitely like a scientific approach to formulating the piece, making sure that its pulse is on the cultural current and that someone wants to share this story. Then there's also the aspect of developing the story. And I meet with so many people that tell me all the time, I just can't write. I just can't write. Yet I have the most amazing conversations with them all the time. I know earlier in your career, you took some type of Myers-Briggs test or something that showed you that you are highly intuitive. So creative visualization comes naturally to you. The mapping technique can help people get organized. How do you take mapping of an idea, of a story, into the creative process using those visualization techniques?
Yeah, I think the test that I took, it showed that, I think it was a Kolbe test, and it showed that I'm a great synthesizer. And I think that is where the intuition kicks in as well, because I can take pieces of information out of the world, out of the climate and the zeitgeist, and build it into something brand new that's unique to me. And I think that's part of what I do with my students. I teach them how to access that part of themselves. I think people grow up in a very limited viewpoint a lot of times, and they feel like, my husband always says to me, where other people see boundaries, you don't see them. And he said, you know, that can be wonderful, it could also be challenging. But it's really true, because I think this is how we all should be thinking. And so if you can find ways to connect your experience with what's going on, it's you're beginning to learn how to synthesize, and you're beginning to learn how to visualize even without visualizing. Another trick that I talk about in my book is our brains, and I'm very into the science, and maybe it's because I had, you know, the medical education background, and I was very well versed with using PubMed and Medscape and looking at all those studies. And I'm also analytical by nature. And I think that if you look at something, and if you're doing like, if you're creatively visualizing, so what is creative visualization? It's really taking the premise that your thoughts can become reality, which is really saying that boundaries are a limit of other people, which is also why I say I don't accept other people's realities as my own. When I said I wanted to have a baby in midlife, and I've written tons about having a baby in midlife, so I actually monetized it at the end of the day, because that became my expertise. My original blog was called Musings on Motherhood and Midlife. And I ended up writing very regularly for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I wrote for Vox, and all about midlife motherhood and what I was learning and what I was discovering. And so what I did for me, other people can do for themselves. And I talk about the techniques. So one of the things I wanted to say is your brain is always working. So when you are frustrated and I can't write, you say, I can't write, go watch reality TV, go watch a sports show, because your brain is still working on what your challenge is. And I didn't realize that for the longest time, but once I realized it, it freed me. And it's a very freeing feeling, because then you come back the next day with new ideas, because it doesn't stop. And so you give it a challenge even before you go to sleep. And the next day you can sit down and possibly write your first, you know, not so great draft.
Yeah, the evolution of a writer and what they want to bring into the world, it's different for all of us. And you brought up pitching ideas to editors. And one thing that a lot of people want to do in this world, and your book's all about it, is get noticed. And when pitching to editors, what are some ways that people can get noticed, what are some tips? Because you brought up the persistence, and we should also be dreaming big. Why not have your article in the Washington Post or New York Times? How can we make sure that we're reaching the right editors and we're dreaming big, but also have the fundamentals in place where we're not getting ignored by them?
And I think that's where my background as a magazine editor really comes in handy with my teaching, because I understand what editors are up against today. And it's not just the print, you know, print back when I first started was king, and now it's not. It's digital. You're almost going to get more eyes on digital if you do something online. But with that said, to get an editor's attention, our attention span is so much shorter than it was 3 decades, 2 decades, a decade ago. It used to be something like 30 seconds. And I think I saw an Ad Age article that said it was much shorter now, maybe 3 to 10 seconds. So you have to like grab their attention. How do you do that? You do it by hooking them in right away with a provocative statement or a anecdote that's dramatic, or a really interesting, possibly scary statistic, or a compelling quote that evokes emotion. If you evoke emotion, and there's been many scientific studies done on it, and I talk about it in the book, if you evoke emotion in the reader, and the editor is your first reader, if you're pitching an editor, whether you're sending an essay or a pitch for an article, which is a reported piece, you are going to get their attention. So there are so many tools and tricks that I share in the 352 pages of the book and my Estelle's Edge. And one of them is craft a compelling title, a headline that brings out emotion. So when I first got published in the New York Times in the Well section, I sent the pitch, a freelance writer pitch, how to bully-proof your child. Okay, so think of it, the editor, and I put that in the subject line of the email. So think of that, James, an editor is getting hundreds of pitches a day from PR people, from editors, from people that want their time for other reasons. And so if you're saying freelance writer pitch, and then you have a headline, a title that will make the editor think, oh, I want to know more about that, or I want to read that. You're now fighting with all the other stuff in the email, but you're getting noticed. And so I got noticed with that email, and then I had the backup for it, right? I had credible experts. I had an anecdote that I could frame it around, which is what I put in the pitch and what I teach my students to do as well. And I wrote the All About the Pitch column for Writer's Digest for 2 years, where I would break down and analyze pitches from editors and say what works and why. So that is one way. And a lot of people, again, it's the mindset of, oh, I should have tried big. Like I had a student who came up with an idea, and I thought it was brilliant. It also included a buzzy word, which was emotional cushioning. And buzzy words are great because editors are looking on TikTok, on Reddit, on Substack for these buzzy words that are credible. They have research, they have basis behind them. And so you can then get interest from an editor on that. And so the other thing is, if you don't have a clip, oh, and I also said to her, you have to pitch this to New York Times. She was like, New York Times? I'm like, yes. I said, they like to be first. You have to be fast, but they like to be first. And so, yes. And she got in with her pitch. And so you have to also, if you don't have clips, and clips are examples of your writing that an editor will feel is credible from a credible publication. Probably the higher level you go, they want to have more succinct clips, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to have an opportunity. So if you want to get an editor's attention and you don't have your byline on a lot of clips or things, I suggest doing something called writing to the reader, which is writing your first paragraph of what your piece is as if it was the actual published article. And this does a couple of things, James. One, it shows the editor your writing style. It shows them that if you have a voice, how your voice will now impact and your turn of phrase. And it also shows them that you're being savvy. You're figuring out a way to get their attention. You're doing it with a compelling title that's going to evoke emotion, that uses active verbs. And I break it down in my book exactly how to do every single step of what I'm telling you now in a smaller way, but concrete.
Awesome. Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about getting noticed, one easy way today and something that a lot of people lean on is being controversial, because there's definitely polarity and things are sticky when you take a side. And even if you're trying to be constructive in your approach, you know, going viral or getting more eyeballs can also come with consequences. I know you experienced that when you wrote My Child is Out of Control for the Washington Post. Tell us a little bit about that story and how we have to be careful about what we want our name attached to in print.
Sure. So when I came up back into publishing the second time around, it was the advent of the mom bloggers. And a lot of them were writing, my kid sucks, I hate them, they're making me crazy. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. You know, first of all, being older, going back into it, you have perspective that I think some of these 20-something moms didn't have, and which is why one of my big things as a writing coach and a writing teacher at NYU for Writer's Digest and for my students is I protect them from writing the things that are really going to hurt them. You know, like I had a student who was in the middle of a divorce and she wanted to write about how she raged at her kids. And I said, nah, you're not going to write that lovely little story, because that will, I guarantee you, will be used against you from the other party. So don't do it. And, you know, I said no. And she, you know, acknowledged later, like, absolutely, because he'd been doing some other shady things. And she said, this would have been a disaster. So, you know, this kind of protectiveness is important. In this case, my daughter was acting out. We were on vacation in Vermont. And she had a later bedtime. She was about 5 years old at the time. And she was just eating too much sugar and just being hyper and rude. And so I thought, I want to write about this, but I want to write about it in a way that A, is going to get me noticed, B, is not going to hurt her, and C, is going to get me into a really credible publication that I can continue to write for. And so I pitched it to the Washington Post on parenting section, which is a very popular section. And the way that I did it was, I talk about in my book that you have to have a spin, because editors have seen everything. So if I just pitch, my daughter is out of control and she's a pain in the butt and this is the annoying thing she's doing, that probably would have been more suitable for a mom blog, but it didn't provide the type of service information helping the reader for their lives that newspapers like the Washington Post, the New York Times do, or other publications. And so my spin was, my daughter's out of control, but it's really my fault, because she might be raging at not being able to get her ice cream at night, but she saw me having road rage, or she saw me getting angry at the cable guy. You know, she saw me getting angry when someone cut in front of me in line at the supermarket. So the idea is, the onus is on me, not on her. You know, she's not being polite to me, but me and my husband, sometimes we drop our P's and Q's too. And we just say, hey, do this, hey, do that. And so I said, I'm going to fix myself first, and then she'll learn. And then I included studies that I wove it in that showed that children are learning from their parents. And so this makes a lot of sense. And I framed it in such a way that I broke it down into subheads. You know, here's what I did. Here's what I'm going to do moving forward. Here's how my daughter reacted. And it was so successful. It went viral. It was syndicated all over the world. It was mentioned on The View. I got a lot of opportunities out of it, including continuous writing for the Washington Post, and they asked me to write a follow-up article a year later. It was like an essay slash article. And so I framed it more as a report card, like how had she done? How had I done? So I talk about, I have a section in my book called At Your Reader Service, which talks about how to frame these kinds of articles that have a how-to or have a service element to help people improve their lives, but how you do it with breaking up the copy, with putting subheads in, with using ideas of like a report card or a lesser, more, better, or more expensive, less expensive, all different ways. And I have a background as a beauty editor. That was my first editor job. And so a lot of beauty writing is very service focused because you're saying what the expensive products do, and here's a dupe. And this is why you should try it. And this is how it works for you. And this is how you can make it work better. So I just, again, in the synthesizing, I transmuted all of that experience that I had into writing about parenting and doing it there. And I help my students, whatever their focus is, whether it's money or lifestyle or self-esteem or psychology or lawyers, you know, whatever it is, I help them do that as well.
That's awesome. So what advice would you have for anyone that's listening, that's maybe sitting on the couch, retired, has extra time and has a story to tell, or someone that wants to expand their thought leadership, get published in new magazines, reach out to editors, but is just a little bit timid or scared of the process? How can we find that inspiration to get going? Yeah. And maybe a good place to start is getting a copy of Writing That Gets Noticed.
Exactly. In the book, I talk a lot about editor etiquette, and you can find editors through LinkedIn. You can go and just say editors for, and then a whole list will come up, editors at Wired, editors at Vogue, editor. So you'll have a name, and then you can go research the editor and see what they've been writing. Because one of the tricks I'd say is to compliment the editor, because editors are people too. When people reach out to me, if they've said something complimentary about my book or my podcast, Freelance Writing Direct, or what, you know, articles that I've written or essays I've written, that makes a difference because we're human. And so we want to be acknowledged. We want to be noticed. So that's another way. And then making sure that you can deliver, whether it's an article that you want to write, that you have the latest experts. And I have a whole section in my book of not only how to find experts, how to vet them, the websites that you can go to find them, the questions you need to ask them. Like I break it down. I distill my 30 years of experience in publishing into this book because my premise and my whole philosophy of teaching is you give someone a fish and you feed them for the night. You teach them how to fish and they can feed themselves the rest of their lives. And those are words I live by.
Thank you so much. This has been an awesome conversation and super inspiring. And the book is astronomically helpful. I love all of the Estelle's Edge that are peppered throughout the guide. Be sure to pick up a copy. Where can people learn more about you?
Sure. I have a website. It's Estelle, S as in Sam, Erasmus, Erasmus.com. And I'm everywhere on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on X. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Threads, I'm on Blue Sky at Estelle S. Erasmus, and I give writing advice. And I also have a Substack, estellesserasmus.substack.com. And if you're looking for editor opportunities, I share them in my Substack. I also share them on Freelance Writing Direct, where I actually interview assigning editors. And you can find that on my website under podcast. It's also on iTunes and Spotify. And I talk to best-selling authors like Cheryl Strayed, Anne Hood, Vanessa Hua, William Dameron, plus regular freelance writers who have made niches their mark, and they've really been very successful about all their writing, business, and craft tips. And it's like an education, a That's free awesome. Education. I also teach at NYU and for Writer's Digest, and you can find that information on my website.
Thanks so much. You've been an awesome guest. I really appreciate it.
It's been such a pleasure, James. I love your program.